Hello, listeners. Hi, I'm Dr. Margaret Vaughn, and welcome to Getting Smarter, a podcast where I get to talk with some of the most transformational thinkers and leaders in the field of education, all in the hopes of getting smarter. Join me in listening and learning.
Okay, welcome. Today we have Dr. Peter Johnston visiting with us to help us get smarter. Dr. Johnston was a teacher in New Zealand and went to the University of Illinois at Champaign-Urbana to do his PhD and then was involved in the Center for the Study of Reading. He was involved in the Center for English Learning and Achievement funded study of exemplary teachers with Dr. Richard Allington. This work led to a focus on classroom talk, which has persisted in the last dozen or so years. One project he's worked on was with a group of teachers that turned into the book Engaging Literate Minds. The other with Dr. Gay Ivey, where they studied middle school reading engagement that turned into the book Teens Choosing to Read. Recognition for his outstanding work includes the Albert J. Harris Award from the International Literacy Association and the Oscar Causey Award for Outstanding Contributions to Reading Research, as well as the P. David Pearson Scholarly Influence Award for his book Choice Words. He is elected member of the Literacy Research Association's Reading Hall of Fame, and he's just an absolutely wonderful scholar, and we're so lucky to learn from you today. Dr. Johnson, thank you again for visiting with us. How are you today?
I'm just fine, thanks. It's very generous of you to say those things.
So I have a few questions that will get started. So before we get started, why did you go into the field of education and teaching?
Well, I had an undergraduate degree in psychology and majoring or minoring in zoology, and I thought teaching was something I could do, so I went to teacher training college, Otago teacher training college it was at the time. And I went teaching and fairly quickly found out I had no idea what I was doing. So I went back to university. I did a master's in educational psychology, and then I was talked into coming to the US to do a to do a PhD. So that's how I and it happened to be that the Center for the Study of Reading was at the U of I at that time, and so I got an assistantship there, and or couple different assistantships along the way, and that sort of set me off on the on well, my career, I guess. So yeah, that's it
Yeah,
really.
that's so
I there's
wonderful.
probably more to it, but I can't remember anymore.
Well, you are just one of my favorite scholars in the work. And, I remember reading Choice Words when I was a doctoral student, and it has left such a huge impact on me, and I know for so many others. I'm teaching a doctoral class now, and my students are reading it. And it's just so many wonderful connections and threads. And so you are really just one of my favorite people in this work. And thank you so much for sharing your work and your knowledge with us. So these are some really wonderful questions. So I'm gonna get started because I can't wait to hear your answers. So what insights have you gained from your research and your career? What might you think about that?
Well, I guess most recently, the importance of engagement, getting kids engaged, that really came out of two different projects that you actually mentioned. One of them with Gay Ivey, and one with a group of teachers, elementary school teachers, K-3 teachers. It seems to me that that we can't have equity in education without children being engaged, because when they're not engaged, they're not learning optimally, and we tend to judge how capable students are based on what they do. And when they're not engaged, they don't show us what they can do. So the study that Gay and I recently reported in our in our book, Teens Choosing to Read. Teachers, eighth grade teachers in a school, four of them, were frustrated with the fact that they couldn't get their students engaged in reading. So they, after reading some of the research on engagement, they they stopped doing what they were doing, which was assigning books for kids to read and having assignments on those books and so forth. So they gave the kids choice among personally relevant books or other materials, and about 150 to 200 books per classroom, and no more than three copies of any title, which turned out to be important, because if you've read a book that you really want to talk to somebody about, and only there's only one copy of the book, then you have to know who's read it. So you start to keep track of who's read the book. And if nobody else has read it, then you have to make somebody read it. So it changes the dynamic there. And also, of course, if everybody wants to read the one book and there's only one copy, that's where capitalism actually works. It increases the value of the book. So, and then the instruction that they used was sort of woven into the read aloud. So they would have one read aloud book, that most of the kids would be interested in reading. So these books were well-rated books for young adults, you know, rated in professional journals and on Amazon as well. And the teachers encouraged talk about the books, and they stopped asking comprehension questions and instead just asked open prompts like catch me up or what are you thinking, and they distributed teaching in the classroom. So for example, if a kid was not particularly engaged in a book that they had chosen, then they would connect that kid to another kid who found that book particularly engaging, and that student would have an incentive to help the other kid read it because they want to have conversations about that book because it's a favorite book, just like adults basically. And really what was astonishing about it was the enormity of the cascade of effects that resulted from it. You know, the average volume of reading shot up enormously. I mean, over a factor of over 10 times as many books being read. Students became more strategic in their reading, and that they distributed the teaching because they would talk to one another and ask each other for help. There was far more conversations among students, but also inside and outside of school, but also with parents and others, anyone who would listen to them when they talked about their book, which they wanted to do. So it changed the relationships among students. It changed the relationships in the families. Improved their ability and also their propensity to imagine what was going on in other people's heads, their thoughts and feelings, which turns out to be quite a hub of human development. So it improved their social relationships. You know, in the community that they developed, there was greater trust. They routinely talked about trusting one another, making friends, and so forth. They became less judgmental. These are based on their reports. We had hundreds of interviews with these kids and also classroom observations and videos and recordings. They had better emotional and behavioral and academic self-control. And parents reported that their kids were more mature and so forth. And they developed more productive identities. So they would talk about how they decided after reading a novel about gangs, they decided not to join a gang after all, and they persuaded somebody else not to join a gang. And they had a bunch of changes in their identities. Their sense of self as competent They talked about, you know, how everyone seemed just so much smarter, you know. So, and of course, because they thought the others were smarter, they talked with them as if they were smarter. And of course, there's a cycle there, you know. And they reported increased happiness, you know. I just think that's a really important piece, because happier kids are better learners. And their well-being is improved. And of course, teenagers' well-being hasn't been going that well in the last few years. And it's, you know, we should be doing something about it. But of course, the least interesting was that more kids passed the state tests, you know, and there was, you know, smaller differences across subgroups. So, you know, we learned from that. We followed the kids through into a bunch of the kids through into high school. And, you know, I guess we documented also the what makes engagement more likely with reading. And, you know, it's things like, well, first of all, meaningfulness, the more relevant books they have available, the better. Choice, that they have choice, and a sense of autonomy comes from that. That choice. But of course, choice is not useful without meaningful choice. So those two kind of go together. Time to read. The students, they had double periods, you know, and so they had half an hour to read when they had their time, so they could read in class. And of course, once they started reading in class, they couldn't stop afterwards. So they would be reading in math and constantly being corrected for reading in other classes. But access is important. They didn't have to go to the library to get books. They went to their classroom library, and if their classroom didn't have it, then they were free to go to one of the other classrooms and see if they had the book. That access is really important. These are all from reports from the students, really. Again, social relationships inside and outside of the classroom really mattered, because it's those social relationships that allowed them to know what was a good book to read next. And once those social relationships and that community disappeared, which it did in high school, because they went back to the same old, they couldn't tell what books were a good idea to read and so forth. So all of that broke down for most of the students, actually. And I think another piece was a community growth mindset. So there was a sense that, you know, it was okay to struggle with the book. It was okay to find it difficult, because then you could have conversations with other people and so forth. And if that mindset were not in place, they wouldn't have felt comfortable actually saying, you know, I don't understand this. So I think that engagement piece has been big. I also found that to be a strong element in working with the classroom teachers in our book, Engaging Literate Minds. I think another thing I've learned is the interconnectedness of aspects of classroom life and children's development. I mean, I think that, you know, our study with the young adults really showed that very much, but also the case with classroom teachers in the elementary grades. You know, when kids are feeling confident, when they have a sense of competence and a sense that they belong in that in the classroom, those are human needs. And a sense of autonomy. Those, you know, are, as I say, human needs, and they're interconnected with literacy development and whether kids are available for learning. I think, you know, you mentioned choice words. I've just revised choice words, so it's going to come out in a couple of months in a second edition, which will be, we'll see how that goes. But when I published that, I actually, the publisher, she said at some point that She really didn't think it would sell, but she thought it should be published anyway. And I think,
why didn't she think it would be popular or published? Or
I'm not sure. I don't. I mean, she actually, Philippa Stratton, is a remarkable person. She built Heinemann from scratch. She and her husband, and then when Heinemann was bought, they built Stenhouse on the same premise that teachers should be writing for teachers. And she was actually given the Outstanding Educator Award by NCTE one year, which she's the only publisher that has ever got that. But she was giving her, she said that in her speech. So I don't know what her reasoning was, but I was surprised too, in a way, because I mean, I thought it was important, but it seemed to speak to a need in the community. You know, a lot of people found that that it changed their teaching, it changed them, and I think, you know, I certainly found in working with the teachers on the book Engaging Literate Minds, that's where they started, was with the book Choice Words, looking at their classroom language, and so, yeah, that sort of played a key role, and it gives it gave more leverage than I thought it would, and obviously Philippa thought it would. Anyway, so
it had a huge impact on so many people, and just, you know, I think when I hear you thinking about this and talking about this, I love how you're honoring students' talk in the classroom and listening to them, but then also you're also saying, hey, teachers, it's important for you to think about how you're talking as well. So that interplay between the two, it's fascinating that the connection is there.
Well, the teacher orchestrates the language that the children use with each other. And of course, In one of the things that we've found, particularly in the K-3 classrooms, is that if you can distribute teaching, and of course this was the same with the eighth graders, if you can distribute teaching so kids know how to help and support one another, then they don't have to wait around for the teacher to be available, and it increases the power of the classroom learning community. I suppose another thing I've learned is when I talk about learning community is the power of teacher learning communities. That was what that book came out of, is a group of teachers working together to improve their practice rather than waiting for the school to decide what in-service they needed. They worked together to actually build their practice. And and of course, teacher learning communities, if they're not working well, they can be toxic as well, which is something I've also seen. I guess another thing I learned is with that group particularly is the importance of a sort of a broad view of literacy. I mean, we built on Katie Wood Ray and her colleagues' work with children making books. And that whole idea of making books rather than just getting kids writing or even just focusing on kids reading makes a huge difference, because it opens so many more ways for kids to feel competent. And because, first of all, they've got their own projects that they're working on, so they can actually be more likely to be engaged. And also, If literacy is reduced to just how much you know about words, then kids will array themselves on a hierarchy of competence, and some kids will judge themselves as being not competent, and will gradually move themselves out of literacy, out of their participation in the literate community. So, when literacy is broadly conceived, so that it, so like with the eighth graders, just their being engaged in conversations about books, that is what made them feel competent at literacy. And all they had to do for that was be engaged in reading books, but also bring to it their experience and their thoughts about meanings and so forth. So it makes a broader tent for kids to have a sense of competence. The other thing I learned, and I think I put this in choice words, was I think it matters what teachers think they're doing and with whom they think they're doing it. You know, if they think their job is to make sure kids get all the words and the meaning right, they'll interact one way. And if they think their job is to help all kids become engaged readers and writers, they'll interact differently. There's a great little study by Susan Engel on that, in which she gave teachers different instructions as to what they were trying to do with a kid, and the different instructions changed very much what they had to say in interaction with the student. I think probably I've learned too that teachers can be caught in ethical dilemmas when they're required to use, you know, canned, inflexible programs that prevent them from being responsive to the diversity of their students, you know, and then they're judged on their teaching success, over which they have limited control. And then, you know, you find a bunch of teachers, some of the best teachers, can't use their extensive knowledge of teaching and children's development. And they end up leaving the profession. And when an experienced teacher leaves the profession, it's a big loss of knowledge, you know, to the community. So,
yeah. What do you think has changed in your thinking over the years? Has there been any changes that you really can point to?
Yeah, I think I've been lucky to have colleagues who think differently from me, you know, and also I've been lucky to spend a bunch of time in classrooms, and each teacher has their own way of going about things, you know, and their own sort of set of principles for operating on what they think they're doing. So I think largely my understanding of the complexity of teaching and learning and classroom life has sort of changed over the years. A long time ago, Ralph Peterson wrote a book called Life in a Crowded Place, and I think that's a very good capturing of, you know, of classroom life. And when I started teaching, I think in my own classroom, I think I was just in the middle of it, and I couldn't get a grasp of the many factors involved, you know, either the bigger picture or the finer details. So I think I've had an increasing awareness of the importance of engagement, as I mentioned. And I think my sense of the detail of knowledge teachers need about teaching literacy, learning about words, building learning communities, you know, that accommodate a broad range of experiences and competencies, I think the detail of that knowledge has certainly changed over the years a lot. I think probably early on and increasingly, I've had a recognition of the social nature of literacy, also of learning and of children. You know, we're social creatures. I mean, human beings are social creatures. I mean, it's to our genetic neural hormonal core, you know, we're social creatures, and learning and literacy are social practices. So I think my understanding of the implications of that has changed a lot over the, over 35 years or 40 years. I think I've got a changed grasp of the difficulties teachers, you know, face in changing their classroom practice, you know, peers, administrators, old habits. Old habits are hard to leave behind, and administrators don't always have a good grasp of teaching and learning, you know, so they are easily persuaded by things that don't have such good outcomes for teachers, I think. So, and also teachers can be mean to each other, you know, I mean, because they're often put in anxiety producing situations, and anxiety isn't good for building, you know, positive relationships. Mm-hmm. So, you know, yeah.
That's true. That's so true. How about surprises? What surprises have you encountered in your work?
Yeah, I guess I haven't been much in the way of sudden surprises, but more gradual shifts. You know, as I sort of mentioned there, there are some, though, like I remember an early publication of mine was a case study of three different adults who struggled with literacy. I remember being struck by how strategic people can be in avoiding literacy, in basically ensuring that they never acquire literacy. You can see that in some early classrooms too, in first grade classrooms and so on. Some kids are very good at avoiding it, and we have to look at what is it that makes them do that. But yeah, I think when I first encountered that, I was really kind of shocked by it.
Why do you think you were shocked? I mean, why do you think that shocked you?
Well, it just hadn't occurred to me, I think. Okay. You know, it just was a surprise to me. And I think when Gay and I was with the eighth graders, I think I was kind of shocked by the breadth of the effects. I mean, when we were going through the interviews and so forth, we were like, oh my God, you know, it was just, there was just so much there, and it was so connected with one another, and it was such a cascade of effects, you know. And we tend in education to want to isolate a factor and deal with that one, you know, isolated thing. But once it turns out that some things have greater leverage than others, and you know, and once you change one thing, then other things just keep changing. So, in fact, in that study, the teachers initially their goal was to get more kids engaged in reading, which they succeeded at. But once they saw how it affected the students, then that became their goal, because they hadn't envisioned that extensive effect, you know. So yeah, I think the breadth of those, of some of those, are really important. I think it wasn't so much of a surprise, but I think the significance of autonomy has probably been it keeps showing up as being, you know, really important. And I suppose another thing that is the disjuncture or uncertainty or disturbingness. It's uncertainty in knowledge that makes kids keep going back to it. Certain knowledge is kind of dead knowledge, so there's no need to go back to it. But when things are uncertain, kids continue to be curious about it. We found with the eighth graders that the disturbingness of the books, because a lot of the books for young adults are disturbing, and that was their preference, to have you know, what they call disturbing and intense books, you know. And what they were looking for, I think, was it was the moral uncertainties in the books that made them, it's like a loose tooth. You keep going back to it. You can't leave it alone, and then you have to talk to somebody about it. And that's, you know, turns out to be part of literacy. It's part of reading, is actually going and talking with people about it. So yeah, I guess that's what I'd have to say.
I love reading the connections and the reflections of the students. You know, in your Oscar Causey Award address, you shared, you know, some of the reflections of the eighth graders. And the one that really stuck out with me was one of the girls had read If I Stay, and just how that transformed her whole view of herself with her relationship with her parents. And I love the way that you give voice to kids and to youth. I mean, it's such a powerful reminder for us in the work that really, in my opinion, that's where we need to be, right? We need to be listening to the ones who are experiencing it, teachers and students, and what that means for kids. And I just really value that. And I love reading those vignettes and all across your work. It's just, it breathes life, I think, to those of us who aren't in the classroom anymore. And I think it's such a credit to the way that you, I think your view on how, you know, the important dimensions of effective teaching and what that could mean for kids. And I just, thank you for that.
I appreciate that. I've been very fortunate again in my colleagues and the teachers that I hang out with. But yeah, those, I think currently the book Teens, you know, Choosing to Read is largely in student voice. It's just based around what the students had to say. And what's interesting is, you know, people keep misjudging. People keep reading those books, to the extent that they do, as if the meaning that they make out of them is the same meaning that the students will make out of them. And they couldn't be further from the truth.
That's true.
You know, and I think both the left and the right are at fault in this. You know, they pretend that kids will read these things literally and won't talk to anybody about them, you know. So, and right now, I think people should be thinking a lot more about that, you know.
I love that. So how about, what do you see as important questions that your work has led to? I think you're leading us there in your thinking, but maybe what are some questions do you think that you're
well, I think the eighth grade stuff really leads to the question of what is the function of the English language arts? I mean, why do we bother? Why do we bother to have kids reading these books in the first place? You know, is it just so that they'll have read those books or whatever? You know, and what we were looking at is, and the students reported that they were in fact transformed by the reading of these books and the conversations they had. And the evidence that we show is that not just the students themselves, but the communities in which they, you know, their relationships with parents, their relationships with each other and so forth were transformed. So, and their sort of their mental well-being is transformed. So, you know, what do we want, I guess, is the question that I think we should be asking. I think we still should be asking how classroom talk plays a role in approaches to literacy instruction. You know, currently we've got the science of reading folks, and they have an idea of what needs to be learned by kids learning to read, but they have no idea, no theory of teaching and learning yet. And so they're plunging forward with a sense of, of just delivery in a sense. So I think that needs to be patched up. I think we probably need to ask, what does it take for teachers to teach responsively? You know, versus following a structured script, and what are the consequences of those? You know, there's a lot that teachers need to know in order to teach responsibility about their students, how to set up classrooms so they can learn about their students, and so forth. And I think we need to be particularly at this particular time in the way people are approaching literacy instruction. I think we need to we need to think carefully about that. I think we should probably, you know, people keep wanting literacy instruction to be more explicit. And I think we should probably ask a bit more about what does it mean to be for instruction to be explicit, because you can't be explicit about everything. One of the rules of conversation is you shouldn't tell other people what they already know. The teachers need to be aware of, you know, not boring the pants off some students and so forth. And what does it mean to be explicit? Can the explicitness come from other students articulating the strategies that they use? Because, you know, the more we invite students to be articulate about the strategies that they use, the more they're able to generalize those strategies to other circumstances. So, yeah, I think probably we should be asking about that. I think probably we should be talking more about how literacy development and human development are linked in classroom instruction, because much of the research on literacy teaching focuses just on reading and not on what kids are learning in the process of being taught, if you like. And I think probably, people aren't looking at the implications of distributed teaching. And I think Jim Gee brought that up in his study of video game learning communities. And I think it's certainly a big piece of what we brought up in our book, Engaging Literate Minds. So, I think people should be exploring that more.
Yeah. What do you think about what do you think about the most important issues the field is facing right now?
Oh, yeah, I have mentioned a few. I think there are some odd things at the minute. I mean, like neurological research into reading is all the rage, at the moment. It's referred to as brain science and all that, but people are routinely making unjustified leaps from, neurological laboratory research to classroom teaching practice. And it's a huge leap that they're making there. So I think that's a problem that we have to, we need to rein in some of those kinds of things. I mean, I think there's a lot to be learned, but how it relates to classroom instruction, I think is a bit of a stretch right now. I think right now the field faces two sort of long-term partial truths that have sort of reached ideological status. One of them is the nature of literacy difficulties. And the other is to do with the nature and significance of phonics instruction. I mean, the first is a set of beliefs about what's been called dyslexia. It's true that some children have more difficulty than others in becoming literate. However, you know, most of the rest of the story is largely mythology. There's uncertainty around all of this, and we're acting as if there's certainty, and there just isn't. It's also true that teaching children the relationship between speech and print and the structure of orthography is, you know, an important element of instruction, but arguments that, you know, instruction like that must be structured, systematic, explicit, and intensive, you know, are simply not supported by research. So there's this, there are these two narratives in the culture, and they're in the research community. And I think sometimes the ideology takes over even from researchers. And I think they should be more skeptical about those. I think, I don't know how the, you know, research community can deal effectively with politicians, you know, making laws based on interpretations of research that, you know, a bunch of researchers don't support. I think another problem for the field is that many literacy PhDs are not trained in actually teaching literacy. They do dissertation research on all kinds of problems, you know, which is fine, but they'll be employed to train teachers. You can bet on that. And that isn't their expertise. So, I mean, we do have a problem in the field, you know, with regards to that. I mean, PhD programs really need to train them. They have to be researchers, but they also have to know about teaching in classrooms, the life of classrooms and so forth. And they need to know how to teach teachers about that. You know, and we have to have some sort of relationship with schools that makes that productive. And I think we're not in a good place with that at the minute.
Yeah. I think also too about your research and how it is rooted in classrooms. And I won't let this podcast end without talking about a few other things, but I'd love for you to share about the absolutely random book. That's one of my favorite. I've heard you speak about that. And I think this speaks to this idea of knowing classrooms and knowing teachers.
It was a little bloke in a first and second grade classroom. And he had been, on entering the classroom, he had been reluctant to engage in making books. But that only lasted for a couple of weeks. And then after a couple of weeks, he actually wouldn't go to recess until he'd finished doing what he was doing on his book. So it was a fairly quick transformation. But then one day I was in his classroom and kids were busy making books, and I pulled up alongside him and asked him if he'd tell me about his book. And so he turned to the front, to the first page opening, double page opening, and said, and read it. It was about, I can't remember, pizzas, I think, or swords. And the next page was about swords, and then the next page was about emeralds and so on. And so I asked him, you know, what was the title of this book? And so that's when he turned to the cover of the book and read, you know, the absolutely random book, which he thought was hilarious. And of course it was, you know, his buddies thought it was hilarious too, because they knew that he had violated, you know, a key principle about books. They should be about something, you know, and he just, he was playing with the rules. And of course that's such a wonderful thing to have happening. We need that in society, and we need, it's the playing with the rules that makes them flexible, you know, that makes them so that they're generalizable and so forth. So anyway, it's a favorite little.
I love that. You know, and also I read the vignettes and also read your work, and there's just such a sense of playfulness and joy. And sometimes I think about how if teachers, if policymakers, and if administrators, if they could see that or hear that in the sense of joy and the learning and the deep learning and the engagement that happens, it seems to me that they would be better informed about what actually classrooms need. And so that's one of my favorite. I think about that often when I go and observe in a classroom, and I think about it that also too, as teachers, you know, and researchers, what we think of is a value may be completely different from what kids value. And I think it speaks to, once again, listening to what kids have to say. And
Well, that little bloke, I mean, he had a teacher who, I mean, I can imagine another teacher who would react poorly to, you know, what he had there, but that's not the teacher that he had. And, you know, the classroom itself was a joyful place to be. That teacher and the others and my co-authors in that book, you know, have like transition music to go from one activity to another, you know, and clean up time and so forth. You know, it's, And the transition music is, you know, upbeat music with pro-social lyrics, you know, and kids, you know, you see kids literally dancing from one thing to the other, you know, I mean, they're just, they're having a good time, you know, and so, yeah, does that matter? Yeah, it matters to the teacher, because teachers ought to be having a good time when they're teaching as well. And, you know, it's kids' well-being is what's at stake as well. And I think, you know, again, the same thing we found with the eighth grader, Gay and I found with the eighth graders, you know, when we interviewed them in you know, 10th and 11th grade, they reflected on that eighth grade year. I mean, they could remember in Technicolor, they remembered who they spoke to, what they spoke to them about, which books, they read, all those kinds of things, all of that detail, where they sat. And then, and they, you know, I was interviewing one of the blokes in a 10th grader, and he was a bilingual student. He's reflecting on his eighth grade year, and he said, yeah, that was my language was really good, you know, because he was reading, or because he said he was reading all the time, you know, and he couldn't explain it, but he started talking about his eighth grade year and all that, and as he started talking about it, he's got this big grin on his face, you know, which I mentioned to him, and he said, yeah, it was awesome. And then I said to him, you know, so how's it been since then? Have you had more experiences like that? And he sort of came up short and he said, no, I haven't. I've stopped. I don't read. I've stopped, completely stopped. I mean, he just, and it was like he was, you know, it changed everything. But he would look, and the others, you know, who, looking back on it, said, yeah, you know, I mean, they said things like, you know, we talked about, you know, everyone has their problems, you know, and it's, you know, we're teenagers, you know, but yeah, there was trust, you know, and people left that classroom feeling good about themselves, you know. So, I mean, yeah, you know, when you're looking 2 or 3 years later, and they would report, you know, running into one another, they don't see each other at high school, run into one another at the supermarket, and then they would end up talking for half an hour and so forth, you know, just that their relationships had changed, and that carried on from eighth grade. So, yeah, you know, I think student well-being and happiness is, you know, we should worry about that. I kind of wished we had videotaped our interviews with the students. We might not have got as quite the same data there, but one of the things I think would be interesting to show parents is the before and after faces of their students as they talked about their literacy lives. Because, you know, when kids are not engaged, their faces are different. I remember being in one classroom. They actually, when Gay had begun the project and invited me in on it, and I remember the first time she took me into one of the classrooms, the kids came into the classroom and they had these sort of blank faces on them, and one of them had she had a book on her desk, sitting there. One of these young adult novels, and Gay leaned forward and said to her, "Where are you up to?" And between looking in front of her to looking to Gay about, you know, maybe 20 degrees her face was transformed. Someone wanted to talk to her about her book, just transformed completely, you know. So, yeah, I think, you know, parents ought to be attuned to those changes in their students.
Oh, I love that. So how about our final question? What are some things that teachers, researchers, and policymakers need to think about when they use research to shape literacy teaching or policies?
let me think about that. I think I think policymakers ought to make sure that they get the full story on what they're making, you know, laws or policies about. I mean, I think, you know, I just read a proposed or a policy document from education, health, and whatever it is, Senate group. Cassidy is the author of it, and he goes on about science of reading and all of that kind of stuff, and how terrible what they call the three queuing or balanced literacy is, and how terrible it is, and it should be legislated out of existence. But there's not a single reference to research in the document. There's only references to Emily Hanford's podcasts and so forth, Jeb Bush's group's website, which has template legislation for people who want to get rid of this approach to teaching children to become literate. I mean, I don't know what to say. And they
mind-boggling.
And it's also the case that the researchers whose work is being drawn on, when they do draw on researchers' work, those researchers have said things quite contrary to what's being claimed for them, and nobody seems to speak up. And I think in the field we probably need to do that, though. You know, when we do, it's not clear who's going to read it.
That's true.
You know, I guess our research on the eighth graders, we reported, in several publications, but research publications, but also in our book, Teens Choosing to Read, but it raises questions, you know, about the value of teachers assigning classic books for students to read in the, same old that we've had, and asking comprehension questions or having assignments once contingent on their reading them, you know. And, what we found was an entirely different and useful outcome when they don't have to do that, because they quite clearly said to us when they're assigned these things, they don't read them. They simply don't, and they accumulate a bad experience with literacy in the process. Probably people who are in the process of making policies about getting rid of some books should probably worry about that too. I think probably that's another thing that's worth thinking about is the teachers, researchers, and policymakers need to think about the nature of science and the complexity of teaching and learning. I think, you know, teaching and learning is a complex business, and science is never done. It's not as if we apply science and then finally we have the final and answer on complex stuff like that. It's not true in physics. It's not true, in educational, the social sciences, you know. So we need to think about the limits to what the knowledge we generate. And I think researchers need to speak up on that. And we need to, and this is a failure of our education, we need to become critical readers, I guess. <Right. laughs> Take seriously the business of conflicting data and conflicting arguments, to capitalize on those, because that's, you know, what research is about, and it's also at bottom what democracy is about too. So, yeah.
Oh, Peter, you're just a wonderful. It's been just such a wonderful conversation, and you're just a hero of mine in this work. And I just, you know, anytime I'm about to enter a classroom or plan a study, I look at your work and I read it, I reread it, and I think about deeply about what my attempt is. And I just, you know, I'm so thrilled that Choice Words is going to have a second edition. I'll be the first to buy that. And thank you so much for just your time today and your thoughtful work in the field, and just all the work that you do to highlight children and youth and teachers and classrooms. And you're just such a wonderful person.
Thanks a bunch for inviting me on and for those kind comments.
Thanks again.
Yep.